does it take to do the impossible? What does it take to level up your game like never before? What does it take for individuals, organizations, for even institutions to achieve paradigm shifting, nothing is ever the same again, breakthroughs?
Our mission is to decode the neurobiology of flow and cognitive peak performance. Access the minds of maverick scientists, groundbreaking innovators, and world-leading experts to understand what it takes to achieve ultimate human performance. So you can feel your best, perform your best, and accomplish your boldest goals. I'm your host, Rian Doris, and together with best-selling author Stephen Kotler, I present to you Flow Research Collective Radio.
Welcome, everybody. We've got a nice attendance this evening. Huge welcome to a conversation on grit, creativity, and flow with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, Stephen Kotler, and a new guest for all of you, Dr. Angela Duckworth, as well. We're really delighted to welcome you both. And I just want to begin by sharing a little bit more, Angela, about your background. So Angela is the founder and CEO of Character Lab, a nonprofit whose mission is to advance scientific insights that help children thrive. And she's also a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, and in 2013 was named a MacArthur Fellow. Prior to her career in research, she was a math and science teacher at public schools in New York City, San Francisco, and Philadelphia. And you are likely, I think everyone on this call is likely familiar with her incredible New York Times bestselling book, Grit. And if you're not yet, definitely, definitely recommend picking up a copy of that. It's a phenomenal book and she's a total rock star in the space. So we're incredibly excited to be joined by you today, Angela. Thank you so much. And a lot of you are more familiar with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, at least through these calls. But Dr. Scott is a humanistic psychologist. He writes the column Beautiful Minds for Scientific American and hosts the Psychology Podcast, which is one of our favorites. And Dr. Kaufman has written many distinguished books. Among these is his most recent release, Transcend, The New Science of Self-Actualization, which tons of you have been loving after we did the book launch. There you go. Stephen's showing it up.
Thanks.
And Scott received a PhD in cognitive psychology from Yale in 2015. And was named one of 50 groundbreaking scientists
in
the way we see the world. So we're super, super glad to have you back on with us, Scott. It's always a pleasure. But I want to kick off, Angela, with just a simple high-level question so that we can all begin on the same page, which is, what is grit?
I will give you my definition of grit, which is grit is a combination of passion and perseverance for long-term goals. So it is both loving something for a very long time and working towards it, even when it's hard, even when there are setbacks.
What are some of the ways that people can develop grit over time, Angela? Let's just start there.
Well, when I started studying grit, you know, I was just curious, you know, where do really, really successful people come from? I mean, is it just that they're more gifted or talented than the rest of us? And that's the journey that led me to the discovery that it's not just that they have ability in a, you know, field, athletic ability, musical ability, writing ability, but this combination of passion and perseverance over the long term ended up being very important. Actually, in my data, not correlated with any measure of talent or ability. So that was really interesting to me, that the people who love something for a really long time and work toward it consistently in a really dedicated way, they're not always the ones for whom everything comes easily. But that, of course, leads to your question, which is, great, but is it something I can change? And I do think that, you know, almost everything, Scott, you and I study, maybe actually everything you and I study is malleable, is something, you know, that we could say like, yeah, if I want more of it, I could, you know, purpose, you know, something that Scott wrote about movingly, I think in his last book, and in the case of grit, can I become more passionate about something? Is there a chance for me to find even a calling? And then will I have the skill sets and the mindsets to work toward that, you know, even when times are tough? Like, yeah, wherever you are today, I don't think that necessarily dictates where you'll be tomorrow.
Yeah. I want to ask a question of both of you. And a lot of your work started out in military academies, things like that. Do you think grit for creatives works differently than in other cities? I know that's a weird question, but
I'm always, I answered the question.
I think there's a difference there. No, I can't put my finger on what it is. I just think there is.
Well, Scott, you start on this one because I think of you as a world expert in the science of creativity.
I've really tried to think through that question. I wrote an article for Scientific American, which I'm sure Claire will find in 5 seconds, called Creativity is Much, Much More Than Just 10,000 Hours of Deliberate Practice. And in that article, I tried to talk through how creativity involves so many factors that are synergistic with each other, that interact. External factors like inspiring people in our environment, for instance, and support structures and resources, but internal factors as well, that with the creative process, you often see a lot of zigzags. You don't see a linear trajectory where you can even predict as a creative person that if you make choice A, then it will be positively impacted when you make choice C. Sometimes, like people like Picasso often said, I don't know where I'm going till I get there. But with all that said, I'm a firm believer in the value of grit for creativity, in the sense that creativity does, and this is how I frame it in my talks when I give talks about the intersection between grit and creativity. So trial and error, to me, it's all about the trial and error. You have to have perseverance and tenacity with this thing you love, even though you often experiment and it fails. You know, you might blow out your laboratory, you know, trying to find an experiment, then you start over again from day one the next day. To me, grit doesn't mean, and I don't think it means to Angela either, and she can, grit doesn't mean that you see it all before you see the full path, you know, in some sort of linear way, and you know exactly the rules to take, and you just need grit to get there. I don't think that's how Angela conceptualizes it either, but because creative people often don't know where they're going, you know, until something emerges through the process. I'd love to hear Angela's thoughts on that.
I agree with what Scott said, and I'll just point out, I mean, I think your question, you know, for example, does grit in the creative realm, like my mom's a painter, right? So I think of her, she's an artist. Does that look the same as somebody who's trying to become a great basketball player or a, you know, chess player? Not to say that basketball and chess aren't creative, but they're not like an artistic form like painting or sculpture or dance, etc., music. I don't want to like make grit into this like amoeba that includes everything. So I think it's helpful to say that creativity and grit are different, right? Somebody who is really good at coming up with novel ideas that are useful, that's not synonymous with having passion and perseverance. But I do think that to be productive in a creative art, whether you're producing films or music or watercolors, there's so much trial and error, as Scott was saying, because it's not predictable, because it's not linear. And therefore, it's hard to imagine, you know, somebody having, you know, really productive, creative career without having perseverance and passion. So I think of creativity and grit as kind of necessary and sufficient to having a very successful, creative, and productive career.
Can I bust a myth? Can I do a myth busting?
Please.
Myth busting. I can't even say it. Okay. So someone wrote, Randy Harrison wrote, exploration is a key element of creativity, isn't it? And this is the myth I want to bust. So my colleague Reb Rebelli and I wanted to specifically look at the correlation between grit, according to Angela's scale, the grit scale, and your diversity of experiences, or the amount you really just love to, you just have a wide range of interests and you're always looking to see how different interests are connecting the dots, you know. And we found that the perseverance aspect of Angela's grit scale is quite strongly positively correlated with this sort of explorative drive for lots of different things. We found lots of other interesting things, which I'm not going to go on right now, but just for making that point, I want to say that there's nothing incompatible about being the kind of creative, explorative spirit and also being the kind of person who gets things done, you know, that you're passionate about, that has a lot of passion for what you're doing, that is really constantly persevering to be better and better and better and have mastery. There's nothing incompatible there. So that's what our study found. And we're actually writing that paper up right now. We have 3 studies showing that.
Quick question for you, Scott, on clarification. When you say diversity of experience, that's a different metric than openness to experience.
We created a new scale. Yeah, correct.
Okay.
We created the diversity of interest scale. It's never existed before. And we found that it predicts lots of things above and beyond openness in terms of creativity and well-being and happiness.
Let me clarify, by the way, my question, because I completely agree. You know, I always say, Dorothy Parker once said that writing is the art of applying the ass to the seat, which I always loved. So one of the things that's really interesting to me about this particular intersection, and I think it's one of the things that it sort of flow makes easier when it shows up in creativity, is that I think for creatives, the grit is actually even harder because you're facing a blank page, an empty canvas, a space where you're not exactly certain what a successful outcome is, right? So there's a level of uncertainty in creativity that seems to amplify anxiety for a lot of people. And I think flow on a certain level assuages that. It makes facing the blank canvas, the blank page, the, you know, whatever it is, a little easier. I think that's one of the things that flow does. There is really interesting work going all the way back to Mike's work, Csikszentmihalyi's work on flow is a very good predictor of grit.
I have only done one study where I tried to measure something akin to flow. It was a scale about attentional engagement, which I think is really the heart of flow.
And it
was
a scale. Of course it is.
Yeah, I mean, you guys would know better than me. I think Marty Seligman and Chris Peterson developed it. They certainly used it. And I found a very strong correlation between people who were, at least on my scale, gritty, and then people who scored high on flow and attentional engagement. And the question of like why that is, I think, is complex. And my guess is that there are multiple reasons why, not least of which is, if you are really gritty, over time you get good at something. I mean, which is, by the way, I think the gratification that I, you know, think a lot of us would say, like, that's the kind of happiness they're looking for in life, to have some kind of quality and excellence in what they do, different from pleasure, different from, you know, comfortable life. And flow, so far as I understand it, this like voluntary attentional absorption is something is very often in the circumstances where you are doing something that requires a lot of skill and you have that skill. So there's this beautiful kind of matching of high skill, high challenge. And it's hard to imagine how you would get to the high skill part without actually being dedicated to something and doing it for, you know, a long time with a lot of effort.
Angela, just out of curiosity, passion is one of the potent intrinsic motivators. Have you looked at others, curiosity and grit, mastery, autonomy? Have you looked at how any of those roll in?
I looked at a questionnaire measure that Ken Sheldon, the psychologist, has on autonomous motivation, or like intrinsic motivation. There are, you know, goals that you could just spontaneously offer. This is in a sample of about 300 adults. So you had to like write down things that you were currently working on that were important to you for whatever reason. But then you had to rate those goals. And in particular, you had to rate them on, you know, how interesting they were, how valuable and important, instrumental they were to like other goals that you had. And then they had extrinsic motivation questions, like how much do you feel like kind of like you have to do this? You don't really want to, but you have to, so you're feeling coerced. Or like really extrinsic, kind of like, is this to make money? Or like, this is really just, you know, I could have been doing anything, but I'm doing this to further some end. And the data suggested that when people are gritty, they tend to have goals that are really motivated by personal interest and by, you know, values and like personal importance, and not so much the extrinsic or coerced motives. So that to me suggests that, you know, if you want to be gritty, it's not from having tiger parents. And if you want to build, for example, like a gritty team, the people who are working with you are not going to be gritty because, you know, you're like making them afraid of you, or like, you know, giving them performance bonuses because, you know, you've created all these extrinsic, you know, punishments and rewards. So I think there's a lot to say about, you know, intrinsic motivation as being the foundations of passion. And by the way, Scott knows better than I do, but there are people like Valorand and others, I mean, who compared to my molehill know a mountain about this, but that's just the little bit I know from the data that I collected.
Can I ask Angela a question?
Please, Scott, yeah.
So I am curious if you looked at the correlation between grit and social media use. I've been really getting the Cal Newport's new book, which is really inspiring me. He is so laser focused on minimizing distractions, and he's so good at focusing. He's such a great example of a human that can focus so intently on what matters most to him and ignore distractions. I would say he has a lot of grit, but, you know, something he has, he's such a good concentrator. I'm just wondering if you looked at the correlation between grit as a personality trait and your online, the use, the quality of the use of it.
I haven't. I guess your hypothesis, Scott, is that gritty people tend not to spend hours and hours and hours on social media. Is that right?
Yeah, you got it to the.
Well, could you take it one step further and say gritty people have less of an affinity for dopamine?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, I don't know much about, you know, dopamine. And I have a degree in neurobiology, but that's from 1992, so it has expired.
Oh, wow. Yours really has expired.
It's
wow.
really, way past the expiration date. So nobody should take anything I say seriously about, you know, dopamine or serotonin. But I don't think it's that people who are gritty don't want to have like positive stimulation. I think that the thing is about somebody who is really gritty, like, you know, Will Shorts, right? Like, how do you not get bored of crossword puzzles when it's all you do and it's only thing you've really done puzzles since you were like 13 or something, right? Like, how is that possible? I think what is so admirable to me about really gritty people is that they are able to derive pleasure and even a sense of surprise and delight and novelty from getting into the nuances of a craft, right? When you talk to like a 3-star Michelin chef, are they bored of food because they've been thinking about it for like their whole life? No, because everything is new. Like, you know, they get in a new case of artichokes and it's like new and they're seeing all these nuances, which frankly, you and I, none of us on like, are probably like, what? It's another case of artichokes, but they can see the differences. And I do think that gritty people have a desire for dopamine, for stimulation, for positive experience, but maybe the way that they're getting it could be different.
That's interesting. Yeah, it almost sounds like resisting shiny object syndrome or impulsivity is potentially an element of the perseverance element of grit.
I mean, I want to, you know, especially given the format of this very special engagement that we're doing here, I want to say I read A Range by David Epstein, and I know
great,
you guys...
Great book.
Right? Great book. Great guy, too, right?
Yeah, like, great guy, too.
What
super
a guy. Great guy.
Yeah, we'll have him soon, too.
So when you talk to David, you know, about pursuing shiny objects, is it right? So one of the things, of course, that David argues centrally in Range is that you can get into a, like, talk about myth busting, right? That excellence is not from, you know, specializing really, really early in life necessarily and not looking left and not looking right and, I don't know, deciding to be like whatever you're going to be, like Will Shorts did actually, like so early in life, because he really is the exception. And I think the vast majority of high performing adults did a lot of exploration, a lot of trial and error, as Scott might say, like a lot of sampling before they, you know, began to like, you know, narrow in on something. And even then they probably cross-fertilize a lot. But I think there's something really powerful there because I have had parents who are like, oh, you know, my daughter is 7. Like, I have decided that they're going to be like a world-class biochemist. It's like, what? That makes no sense because life should be mostly sampling early. And then at some point, you know, increasingly specialization with cross-fertilization, I think. I don't know what you guys think.
Well, it's a great phrase with respect to career development, build a pyramid, not a ladder in terms of, you know, how you move up and progress, which I like related to that.
And so pattern recognition, when you link ideas together, that produces a little bit of dopamine. Dopamine drives focus. Focus drives flow. So there's a creative trigger for flow, right? It's when you start linking ideas. It's why creative ideas spiral. One leads to the next, right? That sort of thing. One of the things that we find is very helpful, because most people tend to specialize as they get older. And when you specialize, you know, the distance essentially between thoughts is really narrow. So it doesn't tend to produce a big dopamine reaction. You tend to get not basically, you get that little crossword puzzle high. I filled in the right answer and oh, I feel a little bit better, but you don't get a big wow that can really start to drive flow. And one of the things that we really tell people is try to read 25 to 50 pages a day outside specialty. So you're actually giving the pattern recognition system raw material to work with, to find connections, to trigger creativity.
I'm curious if you've had the same experience I've had, which is that, well, now, finally, I have a specialty. And I say finally because, you know, I didn't start graduate school until I was 32. So I'm a real late bloomer in many ways. But now that I do have a specialty and I really identify as a psychologist, I feel like I experience everything as a psychologist. I'm always asking, like, why'd they do that? You know, like, what was the motivation? Like, how'd they do that? I feel like when I do cross-fertilize, like I'll just, you know, watch Top Chef, or I'll, you know, I have this like book of children's poems that's like in my bathroom and like I just pick it up and I like randomly read one. I don't know what your experience is, but mine is that because I have some depth, because I do have a specialty, it enables me to read those extra 25 to 50 pages of things that are really outside. And I'm always sort of drawing connections actually back to my work, right? And that's to me like the thrill, right? So I think that if you really do have something which is deep and a craft and you can see all the nuances that are, one bonus is that it's hard to be bored because, you know, it's a lens through which, like, you know, the rest of your experience, you know, whatever it is refracted.
I totally think that's true. I think the more I've learned about flow, the more fun neuroscience textbooks have become to me. Because I get to, right? It's not just reading a general textbook. I'm reading a general textbook to learn what it connects to about flow that I think about, you know, that sort of stuff I love. I think that's one of the best highs available on this planet to humans, actually. Mm.
And when we're really bored, it's very often because you're like, what is this? You know, when students, of course, roll their eyes and sigh and slump their shoulders and say, like, what's the point of this? I think what they're saying is, I don't see how this is connected to anything I care about. That produces the emotion of boredom, which, you know, I think, well, I don't know what you guys think. In some ways, I think of boredom as the opposite of flow. Maybe flow has multiple opposites. But anyway, when you're really, really bored and you're crawling out of your skin, I don't think you're in flow.
I think you're totally right. I actually think extreme pain may be the opposite of flow, because I tend to think of it in terms of choice.
Like voluntary, intentional.
In extreme pain, you can only think about the pain. It's the only, right? It's all your focus in flow, right? It's anywhere you turn your attention, because you're in peak performance, you can start your choices. You have options. That's how I... But boredom would definitely be on there, and it's you know, you're looking at it from an engagement lens, which is totally right.
No, I was just gonna say, like, I don't know that flow only has one quote unquote opposite, right? Because you know, if it's voluntary, extreme pain is a good example of it not being voluntary, and then if it's about engagement, boredom is a good example of not being engaged.
Right, that's interesting. Hey there, it's Rian, interrupting the episode for a second. We are trying to get Flow Research Collective Radio out into the world as much as possible so more people can learn about flow and peak performance, especially during these uncertain times. If you want to help us out with that, one crazy simple thing you could do is pull out your phone and hit the subscribe button on your podcast player. This will get you notified when we come out with new episodes, and it will also do all sorts of cool things to the podcast player's algorithm to get Flow Research Collective Radio out to more people. So we'd really appreciate it if you pop your phone out for a sec and hit subscribe. Now, back to the show. We're getting tons of amazing questions here in the comments, which is great, folks. So keep them coming. So I just want to address a few of these. Scott, there's one here from Gemma. Is grit correlated with the autism spectrum?
Sure. I'd be happy to offer some thoughts on that. And there's an article that I hope Claire can find called The Mind of the Prodigy for Scientific American. What I find interesting is, you know, I wouldn't make the case that all routes or all best routes are through this sort of range pathway. And I don't think Epstein would argue that either. That might not work for some people. And what has really fascinated me is looking at prodigies. And a prodigy can be defined as anyone who reaches world-class expertise before the age of 12. I mean, there's not that many. But there was a certain period of my life where I became really obsessively fascinated with that group of people because they really blew out of this water the 10,000 hours of deliberate practice. They did not have 10,000 hours of deliberate practice. They were such an extreme example of talent in a lot of ways and ability to soak things up. Even at a very, very, very early age, even age 3, 4, they would sit down at the piano and their learning trajectory in Angela's model, she has distance equals rate times time. And the rate part is how fast you learn something. And that's the talent part. And these prodigies showed a lot of talent. But here's the interesting thing that my research led me to about prodigies is that there was much, much higher than average chance that they were on the autism spectrum in some way. And some people have started to be making that link between some autism genes and a real deep interest in focusing obsessively and narrowly as possible on one thing to the exclusion of everything else. And it's amazing what you can learn when you are 100% in on something. So some people at first glance may just look at the prodigy phenomenon and say, oh, they just show what talent, you're born with it. But when I looked really closely and I tried to get into the nuance of it in my Mind of the Prodigy article, is I actually made the case that when the implicit learning system, which that's what I studied in my dissertation in grad school, the implicit learning system, that pattern, that unconscious role pattern detection system, when you focus all of your attention and energy on that, it's amazing what it can look like how talented you can look in something when you spend that much time letting your unconscious system learn the complex role structure of a domain. And the only domains that prodigies show this in, by the way, are well-positioned, with clear rules to the domain. So for instance, you rarely see prodigies in like creative writing. It's not, you see great literature at age 8. You know, but you can see great music performance. You look, you go down the line, chess, you know, you go down the line, they're all great rule structure domains. I think they do show in the way the value of it, the path of intense concentration and narrowness and at one thing at the exclusion of lots of other things.
Scott, is it true that most prodigies don't grow up to be adult geniuses? And that's if true. That's true, like true. Where did their, I think Ellen Winner would use the term like the rage to master, right? Where did their obsessive interest, where did their passion, like what happens?
You're right. Indeed, Simon has shown that most don't grow up to some just plateau. So they reach world-class expertise, but then they realize when they get an adult that, well, a lot of people have world-class expertise in that domain when you're at the age of 30, you know, a lot of people within that domain. And so they lose that motivation because it's not, they're not getting that rewards, that, you know, of all the accolades. It's very exciting to an 8-year-old to be toured around the world and be on national media. You know, it's a motivating force for, you know, a lot of them, and they seem to love it, but they tend to lose it. But the question of where did the passion come from in the first place, this is such a fascinating topic, and I think that we would be remiss if we ignored the role of genes. And that's why I really like your model, which I just glossed over, so I didn't know if you wanted to take up the volley and elaborate on how you took the physics model of distance equals rate times time and you applied it to the mechanics of achievement, because I think it's like one of the most brilliant things ever in our field. And I think it's valuable to this conversation. I didn't know if you wanted to pick up the volley there at all on that.
I'm happy to do that. I'm going to tell you about it. And I also don't want to say that, you know, that I'll say something about genes right afterwards.
Great.
So Newton had the idea that we all learned at some point, maybe middle school or high school, that say you take a ball like this, and you want to see like, what's the distance? You want to predict it. Well, if you know two things, if you know the rate at which the ball is going, like how fast it's going, and then how long it's going, right? So you could have the same distance if it's like a really fast moving ball, but only for a little bit, or you could have a kind of tortoise ball, which is like going kind of slowly, but it does go for a long time. And so therefore it travels the same distance. So distance equals rate times time. Most of us are like, oh yeah, I remember that at some point. And I think that's very similar to the idea that achievement equals skill times effort. Right. So if you want to accomplish something, you know, I hope you have high skill and I hope you put in a lot of effort if that thing that you're trying to accomplish is really hard. And I think, you know, it's kind of almost obvious, right, that to do something really great, like hopefully you're very skilled and you work really hard, because if either of those things are lacking, you know, you're just never going to go the whole distance. But then you ask the question, like, where does skill come from? And without getting into calculus, I was actually a math teacher, so I found this like an adorable metaphor. I don't know how many people are like, calculus, it's a great metaphor. But just to, you know, in simple terms, you know, I think skill itself has an equation, right? Like, where does skill come from? Like, say you're a really, really good public speaker, or you're a fantastic novel writer. Like, how did you get so good? Well, you know, we were already talking about practice. I do think there's an equation there. And that would, in my view, be talent times effort. Right? So talent times effort would give you skill. Anyway, then you do a little, you know, substitution in math. And I think you would then say achievement is equal to your talent times your effort squared, because you sort of like substitute. Anyway, they're very, very hard to do with like hand waving, no blackboard. But I think the intuition is quite simple, which is that you can make a distinction between skill and talent, which, you know, are a little bit like how fast the ball's going, and you know, how long the ball is going to go. And I think that's the intuition behind grit, right? That like, you might not be the fastest learner Or maybe you are like Kobe Bryant, right? Like you're extremely talented. You're like, you That's pick true. It up like that. But the magic of grit is actually doing things for a very long time. And honestly, if you ask me, like, who are the truly greatest achievers? They are typically like Kobe Bryant, like actually both talented and, you know, extraordinarily gritty. So they had both, right? So they have these, you know, everything in the equation is like a maximum. And I think here's my little footnote on genetics. I think intuitively, and actually there's data on this, intuitively, when we think of talent, we think it's genetic. But then when you ask people about effort, they think that's not genetic, that it's environmental or learned. Mm. I don't think it's quite that simple, although we have a strong intuition, and I even have that intuition. It's like, yeah, it just feels like that should be. There's absolutely a genetic and an experiential or environmental component to both. Mm. So it's not the case that talent is entirely genetic and effort is entirely learned. It's messier than that. And in both cases, there's kind of nature and nurture.
Yeah, I love that you said that. You know, the twin studies suggest that, like, IQ, for instance, and grit both have the same magnitude of heritability coefficients in lots of different environments. Yeah, people make all these assumptions.
I saw, like, wow, this, you really do get a lot of comments, and I can't read that fast. But Shefali said, doesn't feel right, luck, right? Luck has to have a huge factor. Well, I just want to acknowledge that. None of us have talked about circumstances, opportunity, luck, and especially current events, at least, you know, where I'm living, you know, in the United States and Philadelphia in particular, like absolutely opportunity and luck, which are not about, you know, your psychology, right? They're about like your circumstances. Those are enormously important and should be acknowledged. And I think in the paper that I wrote this like equation of, you know, Newton and all that, I said, that, like, I'm not putting it in the equation because I'm not gonna, this is a psychology equation, but absolutely these other things matter enormously. So she's
right.
Totally.
I just put a link into the chat box of an article I wrote called The Role of Luck in Life Success is Far Greater Than We Realized. Really cool physics model. I don't know if you saw that physics simulation, Angela, where they look to see, you know, giving people.
Oh, it was like a paper published in the last few years. Yeah. Like Nature or Science or.
That's right.
Something like that. Yeah, I did see that. Yeah.
So fascinating, showing that not everyone comes from the same environmental opportunities. And also, you know, luck just plays just an overpowering role in lots of ways we don't realize. So anyway, I linked to that article.
Angela, can I ask you a question, which is, can you talk a little about the relationship between autonomy and grit? You know, if you go back, Martin Seligman may have written about this. Csikszentmihalyi wrote about it extensively. Autonomy and attention seem to be coupled systems, right? So you almost can't give something your undivided attention over a long period of time. You can do it, of course, for a short period of time. You can be forced into it or whatever course. What have you seen about autonomy and grit in your research?
So autonomy can mean lots of things. Can you just say a little bit more about how you're using the term autonomy? What is not autonomy? That would also help me. Like,
I'm probably using autonomy in the same way kind of it shows up maybe in self-determination theory. You're doing what you are doing by choice. You're not being coerced into it or seduced into it, to use that their language. That's sort of how I'm poking at it.
Yeah, okay. So probably the data that is most relevant to that excellent question is the data I already, you know, spoke about a little bit with, you know, this Ken Sheldon goal scale, where autonomous, I think he calls them self-concordant goals. They're chosen, like, this is what I want to do. I don't feel forced to do it. I don't have to do it, but I want to do it. That ended up being, you know, characteristic of really gritty people. So I think that's probably the most relevant. I can add to that, though. I've interviewed a lot of what I would consider paragons of grit, right? People who really exemplify passion and perseverance and high achievement. And I have myself not yet interviewed somebody who really said, like, you know, I was just forced into this. I say that with a little hesitation because I think Andre Agassi has said that he was totally forced into tennis and hated it like every second and yet became world class. So I wonder if you guys have thought about that, because that does seem to be a counterexample to my intuitions anyway. But I didn't interview anyone like that. Have you guys thought of the Andre Agassi counterexample?
It's interesting. I think his example only works if you become a speed freak along the way. I think that's how it helps. I'm joking. I mean, it could happen. I'm joking.
No offense. No offense, Andre.
No offense, Andre. So sorry.
I don't know him, and I haven't studied him as a case study. And I think he may have said that, you know, he did realize at some point that like tennis was a thing that he could become world class in, and he really wanted to be world class in something. But as I said, I don't know. I do think that has to be rare, at least, right? I mean, personally, I can't force myself to do much of anything for very long at all. I mean, really, you know, the things that I do that are hard, that take a lot of effort, are things that I want to do. I mean, if you said, Angela, you have to become a political science professor, right? Or a hedge fund manager, I mean, I'm pretty sure I'd be terrible, because I'm not very good at forcing myself to do things for even like 10 minutes that I really don't want to do.
You know, you all are raising some really interesting issues about the whole range, the different pathways to grit in life, and the different ways that one can live the good life. You know, I think personally about my own life story and how I obsessively focused on one goal and one goal only for like 10 years. And in such a narrow, like, I'm going to redefine intelligence. I'm going to redefine intelligence. And I just tried to block everything else out of my life. And I think about the benefits and disadvantages of that for my well-being, my health. And I'm not like that anymore. I'm now more diffuse and like lots of different things and fascinated. But I think about that point in my life from high school to the end of college or grad school. And I just think about that time in my life and those choices I made where, if I may toot my own horn, I was considered I was in Angela's book as a paragon of grit. So
I'm
talking as a...
What happened then? Did you feel at some point that you had climbed Mount Everest, that like you had planted the flag? Did you feel like you had successfully redefined it? And then what happened? Like, tell me what happened next.
I've been doing a lot of reflection about my life here, so as I sit here during COVID and I can't leave my home. So I think about my life and the choices I've made, and I think about how all I ever wanted to do, and my dad's in this chat room somewhere, so he can attest to this. There was a period of time where I made an explicit goal. I'm going to redefine intelligence. That's all I want to do in my life. I don't imagine a life after doing that. And I would say that the point where I did that was 2013. The culmination of that was my book, Ungifted, Intelligence Redefined. It was my first major book for a general audience. And that allowed me to put a stamp on, look, it's in the subtitle, Intelligence Redefined. See, I did it. I redefined intelligence. But then I was like, wait, now what? And I did face a bit of a crisis around 2013 after that book was published, where I was like, I didn't imagine in my head that there would be a life after grit. For me personally, I didn't imagine that there'd be a life after being so gritty for 10 years, like at the exclusion of everything else in my life. You know, I would just go to the library. I would live and breathe intelligence research. I would go to the library and just spend 8-9 hours a day reading all the books. You get the idea. It did create a little bit of a crisis for me personally for a little while before I found another interest. But
and then did you find, it sounds like you found other interests, plural, right? Is that like you didn't latch on to like another 10-year interest and then singularly focus on that? Is that right?
Oh, no. I would say just, I guess, my kind of personality is that I'm a promiscuously gritty. That's all I'll say it. Or serially. You know, serial monogamy. That's what I'm trying to say.
Scott, can I ask a question just to interrupt for a nuance? This is one thing. So I've noticed this with writers. Every book always feels like it's the book you were born to write because it's the culmination of things. But sort of always produces that feeling, right? But for early writers, they're not used to it. They don't know it. They've not had it before. So they're like, oh my God, this is I was born to do this thing. And that, which it sounds like what your intelligence thing was.
That's
and
what I've
noticed
like.
That yeah. It's a block. It ends up being a block to future work. Like you have to get, if you think you wrote the perfect book, you sort of have to get over yourself to get to the next one. The worst writer's block I ever had was after I wrote West of Jesus, which is the only time I actually thought I wrote a truly great book. Like all the other ones I could immediately poke holes at as soon as it was done. But that one I was sure was, you know, the one. And it ended up with writer's block for the only time I've ever had in my life after that. I noticed that with a lot of other people. Like when you're climbing that mountain, something about climbing that mountain when you actually, there's success there, it seems to block things. And
what was it like right afterwards? How did you feel right after you finished your masterpiece?
Let's just say I stayed very, very messed up for about a month. I had to, life conveniently provided some very humbling experiences on the back end of that that sort of got me back to a more inquisitive place. What I found is that it's sort of like being an expert puts you in a fixed mindset and tends to block. I couldn't get back to a growth mindset, right? So I couldn't open up and learn and re-tap into curiosity. That's sort of, it was my experience. I don't know if Scott's experience was different. That was sort of what I went through on that one.
I feel like I'm not as naive anymore. And I mourn that in a sense. I mourn my innocence. Sorry if this is getting too existential, but there was I think about that, Scott, in that those 10 years, I was pretty innocent in the sense that I had this idea that there would be a day where I would reach the goal and then something would happen that didn't happen or that was unrealistic to happen. And now I feel like I live life with a more of a realistic understanding of, you know, this is all going to be a process until I die, you know, until the day I die, this is actually one long process, you know, but I feel like I'm not as innocent anymore in that sense. I don't know if any of you resonate with that at all.
That's interesting, Scott.
Yeah, happiest when they're on the ascent. I think getting there, I mean, that may or may not concord with your experience, but I'm happiest when I am making progress, not when I have made progress and I'm done. I know when Gary Becker, I think it's in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech for his prize in economics, and if not, it's in some autobiographical essay. I think he had said that after he finished writing a book, there would be a little depression, almost a kind of feeling of being lost, right? And I think people are happiest when they are pursuing goals that are meaningful to them and you feel like you're really getting somewhere, right? That is when I'm happiest anyway.
Hillary said there are two kinds of people in the world. They're the people who like climbing Mount Everest and they're the people who like having climbed Mount Everest.
Interesting.
Right. I saw it was an interesting, I always thought that was an interesting, and I have in the climbing world, I have actually met both of those groups of people there. He's definitely right about that.
Angela, I want to be sensitive to your time. I know we don't have too long left to you, unfortunately. Do you mind if I throw some quick audience questions to you?
I'll take a swing at that.
Before we have to let you go. Alrighty. And obviously, Scott, feel free and Stephen to chime in. So we're going from Tim, which is relevant to what you were mentioning earlier. How does one maintain grit when the events of the world block me mentally and emotionally?
Everybody is experiencing some degree of stress and adversity and awfulness, but it's different for everybody. So it's just very hard to be empathic, honestly, right? Because if you're out of work, that's a different kind of stress than, you know, losing a relative. That's a different kind of stress of whether you're sick. That's a different kind of stress. The list goes on. In the United States, anyway, I will say that my mind is exploding and I haven't really been able to concentrate myself very well. That's why I look like this. It's usually look better than this, actually. Not sleeping very well, et cetera. So I think maybe the only thing that I could offer that I'm trying to remember myself is that, you know, I think being gritty doesn't mean that every single day, you know, you're running a marathon. You know, in other words, there are going to be some ebbs and flows in your energy, in your focus. You know, there are even times where I'm the heck with this. It's too hard, right? I work a lot in education with kids and teachers, and some of these issues are so complex, and it's so hard to say things that are helpful and not be taken the wrong way. And I'm ugh. So I don't think that grit means that your motivation is this, all the time, you know, 10 out of 10. I think there are dips. And I think what it means to be gritty is that, you know, there is some deep wellspring, which eventually gets you back. So maybe it'll be a few days and maybe it'll be a little longer.
Angela, how do you don't think of grit and resilience as the same thing? Do you think of them as different things? And where do you draw those lines, et cetera, et cetera?
I think of resilience as a component of perseverance. So I don't think they're unrelated. Of course, they're related, but you can be really resilient and not have a passion, for example, right? You know, something that you love every day and kind of is a voluntary obsession and puts you into flow. And I don't think those are necessarily parts of resilience. So I think of grit as a kind of complex, I'll use the word phenotype. I'm sure that's very unhelpful. Mm-hmm. But anyway, and that it includes resilience, but also having intrinsic interest in what you do, and also a habit of deliberate practice, and also a sense of purpose. So I think of resilience as being overlapping with grit, but not the same exact thing as grit.
One of the questions, Angela, we like to ask experts like yourself is we call the research genie question. So if you could click your fingers and in an instant have any research be done or any question be answered, what would that be?
Oh, that is a really excellent question. Well, what I am working on and expect to be working on forever, though maybe I'm naive, maybe I'm in that, you know, period of innocence that God is mourning, is I really, really, really want to know how people can intentionally develop a passion and become, you know, more persevering. I am working on it, and, you know, there are some small victories. There are a lot of things that like don't work, but if I could, you know, snap my fingers and know the answer, like, oh yeah, how do I increase my grit by 50% tomorrow? Should I want to? I would. I don't think I can. If you know of such a genie, you must tell me more at another time.
We don't have it yet. Working on it too. And then, Angela, so we got a couple of minutes. Where can folks learn more, dive deeper into your work?
Yeah. I'm going to give you a website that's free. You don't have to buy my book. You go to characterlab.org, and it is a website that is funded by foundations and individuals, and Scott has contributed to it, and Adam Grant has contributed to it. I've contributed. So it's actually called Character Lab because, and if I have final words, I'd love them to be this. I have never said, and I don't believe, that grit is the only thing that you want to develop in life. I think it's very important to develop creativity and honesty, and now more than ever, empathy and compassion, kindness, generosity, gratitude, which we can never have enough of, humility. So character is what Aristotle said was the good life. And I think it's all the things that we are that are good for other people as well as for ourselves.
Thank you so much, Angela. It's been amazing having you on board here.
All right. Much love to all.
Thank you, Angela.
If what you've heard on Flow Research Collective Radio has been helpful, please consider doing us a solid and leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you are listening to this. Reviews help us connect to a wider audience so we can get these peak performance principles out to more people.